Taylor.
Felicia.
Felicia?
Yes.
Welcome. You've been here before. Just tell everyone your name. We're small group. Matt.
Teresa.
Teresa, welcome back.
Jessica.
Hello, Jessica.
Anya.
Anya and Nathan. Okay. Pleasure, guys. Okay. Mark Wiles, honor and a pleasure. So, when does this story take place, the whole Hanukkah story? Just a little bookmark. There's no prerequisites for this class. You didn't have to be like a history major in college or a history buff. But does anyone have like a sense, like, are we talking about 100 years? No, it's obviously not 100 years ago. 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, like, what? Like,
a few hundred years B.C.?
Yeah, because it's during which period?
Ancient
Greece. Okay, just to give you a little sense. Okay, so I'm going to give you a little Jewish history bookmark so you can, like, understand, because the historical context is actually very important. Jewish people are living for centuries around the temple. Who built the first temple? His name was King... close. His son?
Solomon.
That's good. Close enough. You're good. Not a test. King Solomon builds the first temple. It stands for approximately 410 years. It's destroyed by the ancient... fill in the blank. Who destroys the first temple? In the year 586 BC. Again, you're not going to have to remember this, but I want to give you a little historical context.
It's Babylon.
Babylonia. Okay? The ancient... there were like a lot of these ancient empires. First it was the Assyrians, then the Babylonians, and then the Persians, and then the Greeks, and then the Romans. Is that correct? I think so. Yeah. So, the Babylonians destroy the first temple. Who then takes over as the new... empire in the world? Who defeats the Babylonian Empire? Think about another holiday, another rabbinic holiday that's similar to Hanukkah, but really different. We put on weird costumes and drink a lot, called Purim. Thank you very much. Purim was takes place in ancient Persia. Same territory that the Babylonians, you know, ruled over. And so Babel is destroyed by Persia, and under the more tolerant Persian Empire, we are permitted to go back to Israel, because most of the Jews who lived during the first temple era were either killed by the Babylonians when they destroyed the first temple, 586 BCE, or they were exiled. Most of world Jewry is now living in ancient Persia, which is basically like modern-day Iraq neighborhood, okay? And after the whole, who was the villain of the Purim story? Haman. He tried destroying the Jewish people that were mostly concentrated in ancient Persia. He's taken out. Mordechai, Esther, they saved the day. That's the whole Purim story. And finally, the Jews are allowed to go back to Israel and rebuild their temple under the more tolerant Persian Empire. Okay. Persians are then destroyed by the Greeks. Under, what was the most famous Greek conqueror? He was also a great philosopher. Alexander the Great, who had a very good relationship. A lot of Jews to this day are called Alex, because there was a tradition at one point to name your kid after Alexander the Great. It was a long time ago, because he had a very positive relationship with the Jewish community. But, and this is where Hanukkah starts coming in, okay? Alexander the Great is killed at quite a young age. And his top three generals take over and divide his kingdom, which is massive, into three different parts. The only part you need to know is the part where the Jews were living, which is Israel. Modern day Israel is exactly where they were. Essentially, probably a bigger territory than it is today, probably reaching into Syria and other areas. And the Greek Seleucid Empire took over control of like where Jerusalem was. And they were called the Syrian Seleucids. Welcome. Nice to see you. The Syrian Seleucid Empire. So if I ask you, who are the Syrian Seleucids and what does it have to do with you and Hanukkah? You'll say, well, those were the people ruling over the ancient Judea during the Hanukkah story, during this whole thing. Now, what's also relevant is because even though Alexander the Great was a little more of an open-minded, tolerant, you know, for those times, ruler, the Greek Seleucids, who took over one-third of his territory where the Jews were living, were not. And they were very much intent on unifying the different parts of that empire by getting everybody to subscribe to a certain kind of ideology. Anybody know what that ideology was called at the time? It was called Hellenism, which was very, we'll talk about it a little later, it was like sort of sweeping the ancient Near East. It was like, you know, now, I'm not talking about like the great Greek philosophers like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. They lived way before this, okay? And they were not, you know, these sort of militant occupiers of other people's lands imposing. They were philosophers. And the philosophy of Hellenism was not Aristotelian logic and physics or Socrates or Plato like we've probably some of us have studied in university. The Syrian prince of the Seleucid Empire, his name was Antiochus. He's like the Haman of this story. He's like the bad dude of the Hanukkah story. And he was the Greek ruler over ancient Judea where the Jews were living and where the second temple stood. Now the temple has a big part of this whole thing. Because what was this most central, important Jewish institution at the time? The temple. And if you wanted to pick on the Jews, you picked on the temple. What would you pick on today if you wanted to pick on the Jews? Israel. And by the way, Andrew, I want to thank for setting me up with an amazing black leader who I interviewed for my podcast. It's going to come out in a couple of days, whatever it is. Help me pronounce his name again. What was the first? Tumisani Washington, who started an amazing organization to help support Israel, sort of black solidarity with Israel. And we were talking about, he was trying to show that like people who attack Israel are really, it's just a guise for anti-Semitism, there's no separation. And I said that this has always been the case, that our enemies never attacked us frontally. They always attack the institution that we were connected to, because it's never popular. You know, you sound like a terrible racist if you say something about the Jew. But if you say something about Israel, you know, then you can kind of get away with it because you're critiquing, you know, you're critiquing another government and its policies, and everybody has issues with government's policies, so you don't look so bad. That's why I'm very troubled by this anti-Semitism that's coming from the left. But Rabbi Soloveitchik, one of the great rabbis of the 20th century, said that this was always the way anti-Semites attacked Jews. Maybe an exception with Hitler, who actually spoke about the Jews. But in the times of the Greeks, they went after the temple, because that was the central Jewish institution. Anyway, his name was Antiochus IV, and he himself was a very ambitious leader, hoped to expand Greek culture and Hellenism throughout the territories. He was a very unstable character. He was known to be very cruel at times and exceedingly generous at other times. He was a bit of a mishugana, according to the historians. He was the one who introduced the barbaric Roman custom of gladiator games, which became very popular during the Roman period, but they actually existed already under Greece. He would leave his throne at banquets to dance in the nude with the entertainers. He was like a crazy kind of guy. And now, here's the part you didn't study in Hebrew school. So far, it sounds like the Jews are doing their own thing, minding their own business, and this big bad Antiochus guy is like starting to create problems. So that's not exactly what happened. There was another piece that you need to know that's not so much fun to talk about, but if we want to be intellectually honest, this is what happened. There were a lot of Jews who wanted to be more Greek than Jewish. And they were a very popular group called the Jewish Hellenists. Okay? And many of them were actually changing their names. So there was a famous guy whose name is Jason. I have friends who are named Jason, but back then, if you were Jason, that means you became a Greek Hellenist. It's not a Jewish name. And Jason promised King Antiochus money, like a serious amount of money, about 150 talents of silver, which is a lot of money, if he would authorize the building of a gymnasium for the youth of Jerusalem. And you say, oh, what's wrong to have a nice gym? You know, it's like Equinox. What could be bad? It's not exactly Equinox. Anybody know what was going on in these gymnasiums, the Greek gymnasiums? So that, what's that?
Usually it's like hedonistic things.
A lot of hedonistic things and a lot of idol worship. They, you know, this is like, you know, you've heard of Zeus, you know, the Greek god Zeus and the Greek god, all these different mythological figures in Greek, in these Greek plays. And so there were Jews that wanted to, you know, become more Greek by introducing these gymnasiums into ancient Judea. And the king agreed to this. He offered him money if he would, he offered Antiochus money from the Jewish community if they would authorize the building of a gymnasium. And they began to cultivate these sort of pagan Greek practices to such an extent that the Kohanim, you guys know what a Kohen, Kohen are Jewish priests who were servicing the Jewish temple, nice Jewish boys, you know, religious in the temple doing their thing, and they were starting to sort of lure the young Kohanim away from the Jewish temple service into these Greek gymnasiums. Okay? And they were primarily used for athletics, but they were also a vehicle for paganism and promiscuity. Just so you know where I'm getting this information, has anyone heard of Josephus Flavius? He was a great Jewish historian, also very controversial because he was supposed to have been a Hellenist himself, a Jewish Hellenist. And he wrote a number of very, very important historical works that are relied upon to this day. And Josephus writes that Jewish boys that were getting sucked into these gymnasiums took great pains to appear Greek and not too Jewish. Since the games were often played in the nude, and this was done purposely, because part of the Hellenistic philosophy was the celebration of the physical. That's why you see these like Greek gods with these perfect physiques. They were literally worshipping the physical. It was the literally opposite, the antithesis of Judaism, which believes in spirituality. Now, we don't negate the physical. We are physical people, and we should take care of our bodies, and we should take care of... But that's not why we live. We don't live for the physical. We live for something deeper. The Hellenists denied all that. They believed only what you can see, purely the physical. And there were Jews in there that were going to great pains to actually disguise their circumcisions, their brises. I know it sounds ridiculous, but they wanted to appear Greek, and they were circumcised as small, you know, as babies. And Josephus writes about this. And there were sacrifices that were being offered to Hercules and these other Greek gods in their gymnasiums. And this is what was going on. So this, I don't know, has anyone ever heard of this? Okay, because they're not going to tell you this when you're, you know, 8 years old in Hebrew school. They're going to tell you, you know, the big bad Greeks, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. That's Jewish holidays. But you're a little older now. Enjoy the sufganiyot, you know. But you're a little older and you can take the truth. The truth is, we brought a lot of this upon ourselves because we were trying to be more Greek than our neighbors. Now, Greeks, and when I say the Greeks, I don't mean all the Greeks, but I'm talking about Antiochus and his, they were not blameless here. Jason offered all this money. The king, Antiochus, builds these gymnasiums. It's time to pay up. And he didn't have enough money. And he... I'm just reading some of my notes. There was another, unfortunately, a bigger crook and self-hating Jew than Jason, who in 171 BCE, Jason was removed from office by Antiochus, was replaced by another man named Millenius. These are all Greek names, but these are all Jews who converted to sort of Hellenism. Millenius was once an emissary of Jason who used his position to undermine Jason, and there were like fights going on even between different Jews, Hellenistic Jews, that were all trying to court favor with Antiochus. And they were all trying to become the high priest in the Jewish temple. Now, how do you become a high priest in the Jewish temple? How do you become a priest in the temple of Kohen? If your father's a Kohen, then you're a Kohen. If he's not, you're not. It's as simple as that. The high priest is like the greatest of the Kohanim. It was, for centuries, the most prominent Jewish official. Okay, like today, who's the most prominent Jewish official? Manhattan Jewish experience, you know. Yeah, I'm just kidding. Who's the most prominent Jewish official today? It's probably the greatest scholar, rabbi. Back then, it was the greatest high priest. It was the high priest. There was only one in every generation. Anyway, in order to pay off this huge debt owed to Antiochus, Millenius and his brother Lysimachus, you cannot make up these names, who acted as deputy, took the gold vessels from the temple, sold them to raise money to pay off Antiochus. And when Chonio, who was the actual real high priest, protested, they had him killed. And this is what was going on. I wouldn't call it civil war, but there was a breakdown within the Jewish community. And a growing opposition to Millenius and Licinius began to arise from amongst the Jews in Jerusalem. The rabbis openly preached against Hellenism, against Millenius. They arose basically in revolt, and they began, and fights actually started. And they were literally fighting over the kahuna, which is ridiculous because the kahuna is the priesthood. You can't become a priest unless your father was. It doesn't matter how much money you have or how much, you know, influence you have with Antiochus. But you understand the Jews are living in a very vicarious, insecure kind of way. Precarious, thank you. That's what I was looking for. The Jews are living in a very precarious kind of way. By the way, any questions, please? I know I'm doing a lot of lecturing here, but just stop me. Okay, and I'll stop being so detailed. I just want to give you a little sense. And basically, there were fights, and it started to get, you know, go from bad to worse. And Antiochus eventually established Hellenistic altars all over ancient Judea, in every village. And Jews from all over were then forced to participate in these sacrificial services. And the temple itself was pillaged by the Greeks. And the gold of the temple, forcibly reinstated Millenius as Kohen Gadol. And a war basically broke out. Now the Jews weren't really fighting back in a serious way until one man. Welcome, good to see you. His name is Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Has anyone heard of this man, Matityahu, the son of Yochanan, who was formerly the high priest? He left Jerusalem, settled in Modian, a Judean village. I just spoke to a friend of mine who lives in a place called Modia now. I don't know if it's in the same area. And it was near Jerusalem, and he refused to sacrifice to the idol that was set up in that town. He saw a Hellenistic Jew about to sacrifice to one of these Greek gods, and he publicly killed him and declared, "Whoever is zealous for the Torah, steadfast for the covenant, let him follow me." And this one man started a rebellion against the Greeks. He had five sons who rescued him, and they fled to the mountains in the Judean desert. There were other loyal Jews that followed. Anybody know what these people were called? Who? The Maccabeim, or the Maccabees, right? Okay. The Maccabees? Is that the a cappella group? That's the a cappella group. Okay, that's where they got the name from. Maccabee, I think, is an acronym for Mila Shem Eli. When this elderly man said, "Who is with me?" he had enough of watching Judaism being decimated in Israel, and the temple turned into a place of idol worship. And what's complicated about this story, and it's not neat or clean, is that there were a lot of Jews part of this whole thing. It wasn't just like the Jews were worshiping Hashem and they were davening all day and doing everything they were supposed to do, and these big bad Greeks came along. It was the big bad Greeks, emboldened by Jews themselves, who became so sucked into Hellenistic culture that they wanted to be more Greek than their counterparts. And there were about 6,000 loyal Jews who gathered under Matityahu's banner. They began to strike back, basically like guerrilla warfare, in these night raids, and they would go into Jerusalem and they would destroy the idolatrous altars that were set up to all these pagan gods. And anybody know, he had five sons: Shimon, Yehuda, Elazar, Yochanan, Yonatan. Yeah, I said five. Shimon, Yehuda, and who was the most famous? Which one? Judah. Judah the Maccabee was the leader in the military. He was considered to be the greatest warrior of all of the sons. And then I've got all these details about the battle. Apollonius, who is a Greek general, gathers soldiers to attack Judah. Judah's forewarned. He strikes back. He kills Apollonius and much of his armies. They take their arms. Serum, they send another guy of the Syrian Seleucid army. He hears about this. He figures he can make a great name for himself by putting down the Jewish revolt. And he gathers a well-equipped army. They march into Judea. They're put down. It keeps going on, and the Jews are just kicking butt against a far stronger, and, you know, we were outnumbered. We were out, just in terms of machinery and technology. Outgunned, thank you. Yeah, the whole thing. We were outed everything. There was a guy, Lycia. He was a Greek leader also. He appointed three of Syria's best generals to lead the Judean campaign. Their names are Ptolemy, Nicanor, and Gorgias. I'm only giving you these details so you can like feel that there's a real story here. Like this is not just like a made-up thing. These are real people. Just to give you a sense, they led a charge of 40,000 soldiers, 40,000 Greek soldiers, put them in charge of with another 7,000 cavalry. Those are the guys on the horses. They marched into Judea, and they were so confident that the Syrians would win that Nicanor, one of those Greek generals, summoned slave dealers from the coastal cities and promised them Jewish slaves at unprecedented low prices. Like, we're going to crush the Jews, and we're going to have all of these, you know, cheap slaves to sell you. And of course, that's not what happens. The Syrian army encamped near the town of Emmaus, E-M-M-A-U-S, which, by the way, is very interesting because it's right near where Latrun is today. Has anybody been to Latrun in Israel? What's in Latrun, do you know? They have tanks there. It's basically a museum to the IDF. And what's interesting about Latrun is that the Jordanians took Latrun in 1948. Israel was unsuccessful. Ben-Gurion was the prime minister. He was the head of the forces of the Haganah at the time. And we lost Latrun to the Arabs, but they took it back in 67. And this is exactly where that battle was fought for Hanukkah, right near Latrun. This is over 2,000 years ago. Yehuda the Maccabee gathered his forces at Mitzpah. Which is so funny because my son is turning 20 soon. I cannot believe it. And he was born on the fourth night of Hanukkah, and we decided to call him Yehuda because when we used to call him when he was little, he was a cute guy. We used to call him, you know, Judah the Maccabee. Anyway, it's Yehuda HaMaccabee. It's his birthday coming up. He gathered his forces at Mitzpah, which, by the way, is the biblical site and home and grave of the prophet Samuel, just 12 miles away from Emmaus. And with incredible courage and some military deception, Yehuda outmaneuvered the far larger Syrian army. He splits up his forces, and he puts each battalion under the leadership of another one of his brothers, and they basically force the Syrians to divide, and they conquer, and they defeat the Greeks, and they literally kick the Greeks out of ancient Israel, becoming the only ethnicity. We were not the only minority group that was occupied by the far superior Greek empire, but we were the only ones who kicked them out. And what was the first thing? That's why you have a handout now before you. Well, anybody know what was the first thing that the Maccabees did when they were successful against the Greeks? What was the first thing they did? They marched into the... Where would they go first? The temple. And what do you think they found in the temple? It was completely defiled. It was completely corrupted. Turned into a place of pagan idol worship. And the first thing they needed to do was what was done every day in the temple. Because there's a mitzvah every day to light the menorah. To light the menorah. Now, they only found... one cruse of pure olive oil, But somehow, by some miracle, guys, you know the story. This is the part they did tell you in Hebrew school. What happened? The one little cruise of oil lasted for 8 days. If you take a look on your hand up before you, this is the only thing that the Talmud says about Hanukkah. It asks, what is the reason for Hanukkah? Our rabbis taught on the 25th of Kislev, commence the days of Hanukkah, which are 8, on which a lamentation for the dead and fasting are forbidden. Right? If somebody dies during one of the 8 days of Hanukkah, of course we would bury the person, we would have a funeral, but you're not supposed to have a long, drawn-out eulogy because it's a very joyous time, and you're not supposed to fast. If God forbid somebody, something was going on in their life and they wanted to take on a fast, that's not a time to do it, Hanukkah. Because Hanukkah is a time to eat, you know, jelly donuts, enjoy yourself, l'chaim. Right. Why? Because when the Greeks entered the temple, they defiled all the oils, and when the Hashmonaim dynasty, that's the Maccabees, as opposed to the Maccabees. That's it. Okay. So when the Maccabees prevailed and defeated them, they made search and found only one cruse of oil, which lay with the seal of the high priest, which had enough for one day's lighting only, and a miracle happened, and it somehow lasted 8 days. So here's my question. You just listen to me, go on, at least 15 minutes, about all these details. Now, where did I get all these details about the war? Not from the Talmud, because I just read to you everything the Talmud says about Hanukkah. I mean, it does talk about other details of the laws. Yeah. So there's some stuff, well, most ancient empires, you should know, did not record their failures and their defeats. There was not a lot of intellectual honesty. But there are some Greek documents, and there's a lot of history from that period of time. People like Josephus and others that are considered, you know, legit historians, where we learn of. But it's not in our Talmud, and my question to you is why? If you were a sage of the Talmud, and you wanted to write down the history, like, there's not a lot of instances in Jewish history where we kick a lot of butt. We're usually, excuse me, getting our butts kicked. You know, and that's written a lot about, and we commemorate every one of those butt-kicking experiences, yet we've got an unbelievable reversal of the situation, and the only thing that the Talmud talks about is, oh yeah, we defeated them, and when we defeated them, we went into the temple, and we had to light the menorah, and there was only one cruse of oil, and miraculously lasted 8 days. L'chaim. So my question is, why do I have to go to non-Jewish sources to find this information? Why wouldn't this be, like, highlighted in the Talmud? Yeah, Adam, what do you think? Okay. Oh. In other words, you think that if we... I thought you were saying something different. I thought you were saying something like, you know, we don't want to glorify war. I mean, that's another theory. But you're saying, because then we'll just sort of rest on our laurels because we did what we had to do. And here, if you don't tell the Jews too much about how successful we were, we'll be a little more concerned about living the right way, I guess. Okay, yes.
I think it also has to do with humility. The Jews tend to, teachings are to be very humble.
Yeah.
And not to brag. So
right.
we don't own our, you know, our accomplishments.
Right, so we don't wear them on our sleeve. Hey, look how great we are. On the other hand, I'm just playing devil's advocate now, because we've had so many periods of persecution and humiliation, so much so that a lot of us grow up not feeling terribly proud of being Jewish, because we've been on the other end of persecution and anti-Semitism, and it's rearing its ugly head again. So it would be good to have, I mean, I get it, there's a very fine line between feeling pride that your ancestors defended themselves bravely, right, and prevented them from ramming Hellenism down our throats, and becoming arrogant. I hear you. Yes?
I mean, I don't think the issue is fighting foreign forces as much as it is the fact that Jews were killed. Like, there were Jews who adopted Hellenism.
Yeah.
They were killed as well by the Romans. I think that that's kind of the part that might be more embarrassing to write as a historian.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, it's one thing if somebody else is coming after you, but have to attack, but, like, you know, kill your brother.
Yeah, so I definitely think that's part of it. It's not something we'd want to... I mean, I think it's important to be aware of it, but it's not something you'd really want to celebrate or glorify. That's an excellent point. Yes?
Because technically we weren't fighting, like, they're trying to kill us. We're fighting, like, assimilation.
Oh, that's the whole class. You could all go home now. That literally is the whole class. That's my point.
Oh, okay, good.
Now, this is my theory. My theory is what you just said, which is that the rabbis purposely omitted any of these battles, because if we harp too much on the military successes of our ancestors, it would not only create arrogance, like you suggested, it would not only perhaps, like Adam was saying, you know, allow us to sort of rest on our laurels, but we would misunderstand the whole holiday. What are we really celebrating on Hanukkah? They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. I'm making a joke, but that's the way most of us were raised to think of all Jewish holidays. Mm-hmm. They tried killing us, and somehow we didn't die. So let's make a l'chaim. Now, that is actually true of some holidays. It's not true of Hanukkah. Because think about it for a minute. If there was no pushback, why was there pushback on the part of the Jewish community? Because they were trying to destroy us? What were the Greeks really trying to do initially? Were the Greeks trying to kill Jews? The Greeks were trying to kill Judaism, not Jews. It's a very big difference. A lot of people have said that in history. We have no problem with Jews. It's the religion. It's the philosophy. It's the ideology. You need to be like everybody else. And that's what we were pushing back against. And maybe, it's just a theory, maybe the rabbis purposely omitted all these battles from our rabbinic, you know, Jewish literature, because if we harp too much on the military successes, we would misunderstand what this holiday is really celebrating, which is not Jewish survival, but Judaism's survival. Not the body, but the soul. And that, to me, is the irony of ironies of what's really made Hanukkah popular today. What has made Hanukkah popular? Yeah. Now, if I asked everyone, I'm not going to ask you, like, how many Jews observe Purim versus Hanukkah? A lot more Hanukkah Jews than Purim Jews. And by the way, Purim's a lot more fun. I'm not saying it isn't fun to eat, you know, jelly donuts and light a menorah. It's not a hard holiday to keep. But Purim is, like, fun. You're dressing up. It's like the Mardi Gras Judaism. And you're drinking, and you're... It's like... But what is Purim actually celebrate? Purim celebrates the physical survival, because Haman was after the Jews. Haman didn't care whether you were an Orthodox Jew or a Reformed Jew, a conservative apple Jew, orange Jews. It didn't matter. He cared about... And by the way, Hitler was like that too. He didn't care if you were a Reformed Jew, if you were a Hasidic Jew, or you were an atheistic Jew. It was an ethnic cleansing. This was very different. And it's important for us to know that there are different types of anti-Semites who are going for different types of things. And Antiochus was not going for dead Jews. He was going to kill Judaism. No different than he was trying to stamp out other people's faiths and other people's religious identities. And that's why the Hanukkah story is a kind of, you know, almost like a favorite for American Jews, because it smacks of religious liberty. I mean, that's how the great founding fathers of this nation came here, because they didn't want to be forced to practice their religion like the Church of England was imposing upon them. They wanted to do it in their own way. Yes?
Isn't it kind of ironic?
Yes.
Because
right, so here's the irony of ironies, and I want to read an article with you if you turn the page. It seems that... What's your name? So Naomi's pointing out the irony of ironies. We have embraced Hanukkah in bigger numbers than other holidays. Why? Because we're so sucked into American culture, which revolves around Christmas. And by the way, nothing wrong with our Christian friends and colleagues and buddies practicing, you know, and celebrating Christmas. God bless them. But it's only because of our keeping up with the Jones, not the Schwartzes this time, the Jones, that we kind of like feel we need our own little holiday. And that's really popularized Hanukkah. And when you start figuring out what's Hanukkah really celebrating, it's so interesting. Because if Hanukkah is celebrating the survival of the Jewish people against opposing forces that forces that are allowing us to become assimilated in a different culture. And that is now shining a light on Hanukkah because it's close to Christmas. I just think that's really interesting. And nobody said this better than Hermann Woke. Now, if you never heard of Hermann Woke, he only died about 2-3 years ago. He actually prayed in this synagogue downstairs. He was about 102 when he passed. He lived in Washington. Anybody heard of Hermann Woke?
Yes, but I don't remember what he wrote.
He wrote Marjorie
Morningstone?
Thank you. He wrote The Winds of War. He wrote Cain Mutiny. He was a great American playwright and novelist and a great Jew, because in his 20s already, it was pretty much assimilated. He had a grandfather who was like an observant Jew, but his family didn't raise him to be that. And he struck up a relationship with the rabbi right here in this synagogue. His name is Rabbi Leo Young. He was my dad's professor at Yeshiva University. By the way, this room that you're in, it's just like so much history going on here. Because when I first came here 25 years ago or something, a long time ago, on that wall was a picture of Rabbi Leo Young. I took it off the wall because he was freaking everybody out. Just like everybody, his eyes were like very... He was a great scholar and a great rabbi, and he convinced Hermann Woke, who was already famous in his 20s, for writing these playwrights and these things that were made into movies. He convinced him to write a book about his return to traditional Judaism. And the book is called This Is My God. And I really recommend it. Leah, we should tell everybody about this book in the email. This Is My God. It's written very 1950s. It's like, but he writes so beautifully. And so follow with me. This is what he had to say about Hanukkah in his book. In 1,000 years, anybody have the handout? I know somebody, if you'd like one, please.
Thank you.
Anybody else needs? Please. In 1,000 years, it's the second page, of national existence on the soil of Palestine, the Jews over and over drove out oppressors and regained independence. But the Maccabean War, a battle for religious liberty, alone found a place in the rites of our faith. It stood out. It was the Jews' first full-scale encounter with the question that was to haunt them the next 2,000 years, which is, can a small people, that's us, dwelling in a triumphant major culture, that's them, take part in the general life and yet hold on to its identity? Or must it be absorbed into the ranks and the ways of the majority? And the reason I'm reading this with you now is because this is the same issue we have today. Can we remain a distinct minority living amongst the majority culture, participate in American life, be good Americans, and still hold on to our Jewish identity? In the two great worlds of current affairs, the communist empire, okay, he wrote this in the 50s, which so much resembles an ancient military dictatorship, and the tolerant, skeptical free West, they face the question again. The communist position on the Jews is generally, though, with less crudity, that of Antiochus. Our religion, the Soviets consider a barbaric relic, superseding wisdom sounded by Marxism, the training of children in this explode. Okay, we don't have to read. Basically, he says, because it's not really relevant anymore today, in terms of, let's say, communism. But he said, basically, for the Greek religion, substitute Marxism, and Russian Jews are back where their fathers were in 168 BCE, with whatever differences you find in the relative truth and beauty of the Greek and communist cultures. But then he speaks about us in America. The challenge of the West is different, but just as serious. The proposition is the old one, that the Jews are confronted with a better way of life and should give up their religion for it. Forces that are not coercive and therefore do not call forth the human impulse to fight them urge Jews along this path. You see how that line is so loaded. What's tricky about being an American Jew is that no one's putting a gun to your head and saying, give it up. Be like us. In fact, just the opposite. This country was founded on principles of religious liberty. You do you. That's what America is. Then why do we feel that compulsion to kind of like, why do we get sucked into everyone else's ism other than our own Judaism? The position of the government, indeed the deep conviction of most American leaders, is that the Jewish community has the right to hold fast to the faith of its fathers and ought to do so. What contradicts them is the title... Oh, okay. Is yours missing? Okay, this is missing a page. I really, really am sorry. Hold on. I'm going to get the... Where do I have a copy of the book?
One second. We're literally missing a page. Give me one second, guys.
Do you see this is my God there? Please stand by. This is embarrassing. Hold on. Yeah. Okay, what page is it there? What page?
119.
Okay, 119. Okay. I'll just read you the rest that's missing. 119? No. Hold on. Let's look up Hanukkah. In here. All right, it's a different edition. Here. Here. Okay. The challenge of the West is different. We read forces that are not coercive and therefore do not call upon the human impulse to fight them urge Jews along this path. The position of the government and the deep conviction of most American leaders is that the Jewish community can do whatever they want. What contradicts them, is what we left off, is the tidal force that D. Turcavelli, the great writer, long ago marked as the great weakness of a democracy in his unforgettable phrase, quote, the tyranny of the majority. What do you think the tyranny of the majority means? It's kind of like peer pressure gone wild. This is like what everyone else is doing. It's a certain tyranny when you're living and everyone else is the pressure to emulate neighbors, the urge to conform to popular views and manners, the deep fear of being different. These in the United States are the forces of Antiochus. Where the power of the sword long ago failed, the power of suggestion has recently been doing rather better. We'll copy this and send this to you as an email. You got to have this. It's like powerful. It would be pleasant to believe that the stabbing relevance of Hanukkah to Jewish life in America has occasioned the swell of interest in the holiday. But a different and perfectly obvious cause is at work. By a total accident of timing, this minor Hebrew celebration falls close in the calendar year to a great holy day of the Christian faith. This coincidence has all but created a new Hanukkah. The old Hanukkah was a shadowy half-holiday of midwinter, a time of early night and late morning. Right? Look outside. It was 5 o'clock. It was like pitch black today. Of snow and slush, days filled with blue-gray gloom only half dispersed by feeble yellow street lamps. He's just a brilliant writer. It hardly seemed a holiday at all. Fathers left for business in the morning in work clothes. Children trudged off to school by day, scrawled homework at night. There was no celebration in the synagogue. No scroll to read, no colorful costumes, no Bible story. For 8 nights, running one's father, when he came home from work, gathered the family, chanted a melody heard only at this time, so that it came forever to recall the sadness of winter twilight, the feel of cold, wet wind on chapped hands, the hiss of steam radiators, and the smell of falling snow. And he lit the candles in an 8-branch menorah on the windowsill. 1 the first night, 2 the second, and so forth, until on the last night, 8 candles flared in a row. But even then, the menorah made but a quiet little blaze. The candles, like the holiday, were slender and unpretentious. Pale orange, inclined to bend and wilt, quickly burned out, not at all like the stout Shabbat candles that flamed half the night. First evening, all right, he goes on and on. He talks about Hanukkah growing up, what it was like for him as a little boy growing up. And Lotgis, you know, and then he writes here, it was entirely natural for a new Jewish generation growing up in the United States to feel each December like children in the dark outside of a house where there was a gay party. Not like a gay party, but like a party with happy people. This is the way people wrote. Pressing their noses wistfully against the windows. That Judaism had its own rich and varied occasions of gaiety was beside the point. Most second-generation Jews were but poorly trained in their own faith. And anyway, the Christians had a brilliant midwinter feast, and the Jews did not. Some families solved the problem in the simplest way by introducing Christmas trees, Christmas presents, and Christmas carols. See, it wasn't just that Jews were intermarrying and they had spouses who were Christian. There were just fully Jewish families who felt bad that their kids were being left out of the big Christian feast with the fakakta little menorah and the dreidel. It was like they felt like losers. This is what he's saying. Some families solved the problem by introducing Christmas trees, Christmas presents, Christmas carols. They argued it was harmful for their children to feel underprivileged, and that the Christmas tree was a mere pleasant ornament of the season without religious content. Meantime, in schools where there were large numbers of Jewish children, this is before the Jewish day school movement, there were very few Jewish schools. You went to public school, like I'm sure many of us here did, and everybody's, you know, sort of celebrating Christmas. It's a different time in America. You know, where, you know, my father always talked about this. He had to recite, you know, school prayer, which was basically to Jesus, every morning in public school. Meantime, schools, there were large numbers of Jewish children. It was a dual celebration of Christmas and Hanukkah as an official symbol of mutual courtesy and tolerance. This, in turn, generated a new Jewish interest in Hanukkah. Even those Jews who were celebrating Christmas in their homes, tree, holly, born as the King of Israel and all, began to find it seemly to add an electric menorah to their windows, and perhaps even to light the candles. This apparently solved the problem by giving the children the best of both worlds. And then he continues, I'm going to finish up in a minute. The aggrandizement of Hanukkah itself is a fortunate accident. The level of knowledge of all Judaism must rise when any part of it happens, for whatever reason, to gain attention. The son of my skeptical friend is not likely to stop after learning about Hanukkah. He says it's a good thing. Like, who cares if what inspired Jews to start doing Hanukkah was Christmas? Because maybe somebody starts doing it a little and they're like, oh, this is interesting. And they'll start asking questions about other Jewish holidays or ideas. And he says the son of my skeptical friend is not likely to stop after learning about Hanukkah. But a lack of clear and satisfying religious identity hurts American Jews most in December. That's why the apparently trifling issue of the Christmas tree generates such obduracy and such resentment. It rasps an exposed nerve. It's a good thing that Hanukkah is then at hand. If the old custom of Hanukkah money has become the new custom of Hanukkah gifts, that's a minor shift of manners. The tale of the Feast of Lights, with all of its too sharp comment on our life nowadays, is very colorful. It's of the greatest use in giving the young a quick grasp of the Jewish historic situation. The gifts win their attention. The little candles stimulate their questions. The observance seems tooled to the needs of self-discovery. And then he goes on, I'll finish. Hanukkah candles burn in the windows so that the passerby can see them. The sages call this proclaiming the miracle. And then he ends it by saying, our whole history is a fantastic legend of a single day's supply of oil lasting 8 days, of a flaming bush that is not consumed, of a national life that in the logic of events should have flickered and gone out long ago, still burning on. That is the tale we tell our children in the long nights of December when we kindle the little lights while the great Christian feast blazes around us with its jeweled trees and familiar music. The two festivals have one real point of contact. Had Antiochus succeeded in obliterating Jewry a century and a half before the birth of Jesus, there would have been no Christmas. The feast of the Nativity rests on the victory of Hanukkah. You know how he ends it?
It's so brilliant. He's saying, and he doesn't say it in these words, you feel so insecure because you're like this little Jewish guy with the Hanukkah, you know, with a little menorah, and everybody else is going crazy with the... If it wasn't for the Hanukkah story, there would have been no Christianity, because the Jews wouldn't have lived. And the Hanukkah story takes place even before the beginning, before Jesus was alive. He lived in the Roman Empire, in the Roman period, which took place after the Greeks. And we're feeling insecure. We gave the world Christmas, in a sense. We gave the world all of the great monotheistic faiths. What are you feeling insecure about? And he has this other, I was looking for it before, but I got thrown off because of the photocopy. He has this like image of like a little Jewish kid with his nose pressed up against like a glass, like somebody's thing, and they're watching the family with the jeweled trees and the eggnog, and they're singing songs, and like, ugh, look at us. You know, we're like this little minority people. Now, we probably don't feel this way anymore, or we don't feel this. He's writing about his experience growing up in the 1940s and the 1950s in America. Very different than today. But you know what's still today, and this is why I read this? This is because we're still celebrating a holiday that is celebrating the Jewish Judaism survival in the face of another ism. Then it was Hellenism. I don't know what the ism is today. But we as Jews, because we're cosmopolitan and we like getting involved in the whole world, we get sucked into other people's ideologies and philosophies, and we look at our own Judaism like it's okay. And we forget how much depth there is to our Judaism. And we forget that it's only because of Judaism that these other faith systems and philosophies even developed to begin with.
And we're just, like the
insecure, anxious, you know, Jew, who's, you know, it kills me every time I watch a show on TV that you know was written by Jews, or playing a Jewish person. It's always someone who's questioning their Judaism. It's not terribly proud of who they are. It's just. I mean, you could think your favorite show. Unfortunately, it's almost across the board like that. And we have so much to be... It doesn't mean we should walk around and be arrogant and wear our Judaism on our sleeves. But we should feel very proud of our ancestors who stood up for being Jewish and being religiously Jewish. Whether you practice personally, you don't practice personally... They were standing up for the principles and the values of Torah and of Judaism against Hellenism. And the irony of ironies is that this same holiday that gets celebrated by more Jews because of its close proximity to Christmas, because we become so assimilated in the United States, gets more attention. But what aspect of the holiday are we actually focusing on? They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat? Or what is it about the religion itself? The spirituality. We believe, and we brought this idea to the world, that there are spiritual forces that you can't see. There's a God that cannot be perceived through our senses. The Greeks denied that. We did not invent it. We believe it's the reality. But we did reveal it to the world. And that's how Christianity and Islam both developed. Out of Judaism. And that's something we should be incredibly proud of. And when we light that menorah, and maybe that's why also the rabbis focus so much on the menorah, because what is it really? And I'll end with this, and any questions or comments. What are we really doing? What's the ritual of Hanukkah? There's only one real ritual, and that's lighting the menorah every night. We also recite the Hallel special prayer. Light represents Torah. And we are basically trying to illuminate the world with our Torah. And that's why, where do we put the menorah, ideally? Right, on the windowsill. Except if you have a really beautiful view of the building next door, of like the brick wall. You can just put it in the middle of your apartment where the most people hang out. Because it's supposed to be seen by others. And the idea of lighting that menorah, putting it out there, and saying, hey, we have a lot to be proud of. And not just that we're physically around, because that's not what we're celebrating. That's Purim. Hanukkah is celebrating that Judaism
spirituality, the soul, is still around. And we have a lot of light to continue to give to the world. It shouldn't make us angry against the beautiful people we live around who happen not to be Jewish. Please don't walk out of here and misunderstand this. I'm not trying to compare our neighbors and our friends who happen not to be Jewish to the ancient Greeks. You know, they're not doing what the ancient Greeks, which was putting a gun to our head and saying, be Greek or die. Okay, no one's doing that in America. It's just the opposite. But the tyranny of the majority says woke. The pressure to emulate our neighbors, to kind of like look at, you know, other peoples and other ideologies as being superior to our own, that's unfortunately something we're troubled by. And it's something I think to think about on Hanukkah. Yeah. Any questions or comments, please? Not all at once. yeah, please.
Can you pose a question about where we've been all the story?
Yeah.
Sure, actually,
okay, good. I mean, which information? Which part? Like, the first part of tonight's class?
Yeah.
All the history comes, a lot of it from... Okay, so I'll tell you, I got it from... I'm not a historian, so I'm not like an expert on original source historical records. So I got a lot of my information from a three-volume work written by Beryl Wine, who was a great Jewish historian. I forgot what it's called, but I can put it in the... And he's got a lot of details in different epochs in Jewish history. But most of the primary sources from where modern-day historians get this information is Josephus and other ancient historians who recorded the happenings of the Greek Empire, just like there was history in the Babylonians before and the Romans after. There's always debate and discussion, but it's not a terribly controversial. It's nothing I said that is like called into question. I gave you broad strokes just to give you a sense of like the battles and all that. What's curious is that we don't have a lot of that in our own literature. And I was always troubled by that. I'm like, why wouldn't we want to, like, you know, show everyone that? Because I also think sometimes we grow up hearing about so much anti-Semitism, so much persecution, that we don't think that, you know, I mean, thankfully we have Israel, and the IDF is strong, and Israel is strong. So hopefully we don't associate Jews with weakness. But before the state of Israel, the last 2,000 years, getting kicked around from country to country, there was a pretty strong association with helplessness and weakness and being Jewish. That's changed pretty dramatically in the last 70 plus years. It wasn't always like that. 2,000 years ago, we were the only ethnicity that was successful in kicking the ancient Greeks out of one of their colonies. So I think that's pretty unbelievable. But that's where all of that information is. Any other? Yeah.
Why would you say that the story of Hanukkah was never like written down with the Megillah and Esther?
So that's interesting. It never. There's no canonized. It was never. You know what I mean by canon? Like, it's not. There's no part of the Bible. Now there is another source. By the way, this is good. These are good backup questions. There's two other sources. It's referred to as apocryphal literature. Not because it's not true, but because for whatever reason it didn't make it into the canon of the Hebrew scripture, the Bible. It's called Maccabees 1, Maccabees 2. It was written by different people during that epoch about stories, homilies having to do with Hanukkah. You can get it. If you go online, you'll see. It's called Maccabees 1, Maccabees 2, and that's where some of the history comes from as well. There were no prophets that kind of wrote up the story. Like, who wrote the biblical story of Esther and Purim? So that was Mordechai and Esther. And Mordechai was considered a prophet. And she was I don't know. We never really had... There were no group of rabbis that sat down and wrote the story. But the whole story is just that we survived, we kicked them out, and we went into the temple, and it wasn't... That's the whole story.
Which happened?
What's that?
Like the Purim story.
The Purim took place before. We were saying earlier. So the Babylonians, Persians, and then the Greeks. So the Purim story took place a few hundred years earlier. The Hanukkah story takes place about 200 years into the Second Temple era. So the Purim story starts right after the Jews are kicked out of Israel, when the first temple was destroyed in 586 BC by the Babylonians, that's when the Purim story starts. It ends with Darius, who was the more tolerant Persian emperor. Some say Darius was Queen Esther's son, which would explain his being nice to the Jews, allowed the Jews to come back to Israel. We build the temple under Herod. Herod the Conqueror built the second temple for the Jews. Same person who built Masada, same person who built a lot of different edifices. When you go around, you know, the tour guides in Israel used to call him the Donald Trump of yesteryear. There are a lot of similarities, believe it or not. He was like very, you know, gold everywhere kind of thing. And he, why are we talking about this? So 200 years after Herod builds the second temple is when the Hanukkah story is taking place. So what's the end of the Hanukkah story, by the way? What's the ending? We still have our temple. We just cleaned it up of all the schmutz of the Hellenists, kicked it out, and then we went back to the temple service. We lived in Israel as an independent people until 200 years later, when who comes along and destroys that second temple? Is the postscript. That's the Romans. The Romans destroy the second temple because they basically conquer, you know, the Greek Empire afterwards. Yes?
This may sound like a strange question, but why was there only one temple? Like in a neighborhood, you usually have several.
Right,
so all Jews.
Two Jews, three opinions. Yeah, I know. On 86th Street, there's like five. I know.
I always thought of that. I mean, it sounds funny, but...
So can anyone, that's a really good question. So the temple is not like a synagogue. The synagogues, our modern day synagogues, are attempts to replicate aspects of the ancient temple. The temple was built because of a command in the Bible. First it began with God commanding to Moses to build a sanctuary. V'asulu mikdash, it says in the book of Exodus, make for me a sanctuary, v'shachanti b'tocham, and I will dwell among them. And we had this mobile tabernacle, the Mishkan, which traveled around, but it was primarily based in Shiloh. We actually went to Shiloh this summer to see where the tabernacle sat for over 300 years. There's archaeological evidence, hard archaeological evidence, of the tabernacle's presence in Shiloh for centuries. That tabernacle, there was another verse in the Bible where God commands that the tabernacle be replaced by a permanent temple in Jerusalem, which would be a place where Jews would come and bring sacrifices and offerings with the Levites and the Kohanim to God. One place where is the temple supposed to be? On the Temple Mount. That's what we call it, the Temple Mount, right in back of where the Kotel. The Wailing Wall is the last remaining of the four walls that surrounded the ancient Herodian temple, the second temple. And that's, God purposely wanted one structure. It was the centralized place of Jewish gathering and worship for almost 1,000 years of Jewish history, because there were two temples, each one was over 400 years.
So how many people did it hold?
A lot. It was massive.
And what about Jews that didn't live in Jerusalem? Did they go to temple?
So there was, that's a very good question. When the temple stood, that was it. And there was a command in the Bible that all Jewish families... pilgrimage, basically.
Really?
You know, like where the Hajj comes from, actually, in the Islamic tradition. But it all started with that. That's why we call, what do we call the three festivals? Regalim. Shalosh Regalim, from the word regal, means a foot, because you were supposed to travel to Jerusalem to be at the temple, Passover, Sukkot, and Shavuot. There were no other. Now, there were places of meeting in other countries and places, but they were not really considered so significant. When the temple was destroyed, then our synagogue started taking a more prominent part of Jewish life.
So it was also a meeting place.
It was everything.
For Jewish people to congregate.
It was everything. And by the way, not only for Jewish people, the Jewish temple is referred to by Isaiah the prophet as a place of meeting for all nations of the world. There were non-Jews that would come and bring sacrifices in the Jewish temple, and Jews were bringing offerings for non-Jews in the temple too. But it was the place, and when we talk about the Mashiach coming and the Jewish people coming back, we're talking about reinstating the temple, and the temple will be rebuilt. What will happen to MJE and all these other synagogues? I'm not sure. Never thought about that. Literally never thought about that till just now. But that was like the central place of for Jews for close to 1,000 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big deal. Yes.
Where does the dreidel come into this story?
That's an, anybody know what the deal is with the dreidel? Fake playing, because the Greeks forbade Jews from assembling together, praying together, studying Torah together. So one way of basically evading the Greek decrees was to basically study Torah against the law, and then when they would come around, they'd put away the books quickly, and they'd have a dreidel, and they'd make believe they got together just to gamble and to play. That's the legend of how that developed.
I know, like, historically.
I don't know how historically accurate. They were doing something to basically evade the Greek laws, and there was this tradition that they were gambling. You know, playing games. You know, like it's a top. It was just like a top, and they had different numbers, and depending on how it fell, you know, you could win something. That's how also I think the whole get, and how many of you guys got money on Hanukkah?